Welcome back to Discursion Podcast, where we discuss films recently released on home media, Blu-ray disc, DVD disc, contemporary films, classic films, cult films. Today we're going to be discussing The Brothers and Sisters of the Toda Family, which is a 1941 Japanese movie directed by Yasujiro Ozu. And it's not one that I was even aware of before you mentioned it to me, Dominic, because I think maybe it's one of his minor films that was celebrated, you know, domestically.
Yeah, I read
at the time, but I probably hasn't travelled as well as, say, no. Tokyo Story, which listeners might be a bit more aware of.
Well, it's interesting because it's actually, in case anyone's confused about where to find it, it's the version we've been watching is an extra on the BFI Blu-ray of Tokyo Story, and then yeah, they put this as a bonus, and it's a sort of unremastered version, isn't it? So it seems like they've scanned a single print. That's what it looks like. So it looks very handsome in places, and in some other places it's a little bit beaten up, and the sound's a bit scratchy, but that sort of adds to the experience. But yeah, I believe it was his sort of first big hit in Japan, wasn't it?
Yeah, and you're completely right. The BFI presentation, it feels like we're doing archival research of that period in Japan and what was popular at the time. I mean, just having read up a little on the film, it might be helpful to mention that this is, yeah, it's the 1940s, so it's wartime. And I believe at this time, similar to, you know, in some, you know, in Britain and other national cinemas, they're trying to promote the national spirit, which might be a useful framing context for this film. So it's a film that is made, you know, I believe after Ozu has done military service himself as well, so he's aware of that. And probably what I'd say is, when I think about other movies by Ozu that I like, that have a kind of almost timeless appeal, that they have a kind of a calmness about them, or the characters, they're clearly kind of part of the society in which they live, but they also seem separate and they're sort of allowed to like express themselves in the family unit, and that seems quite timeless and you know, can be enjoyed by contemporary audiences. This one somehow seems a bit more rooted in the 40s, partly because China is mentioned as a military outpost. And so I suppose my initial thought on this film is that it has some quintessential Ozu kind of markers of it's about a family and tension within the family, generational divides, and some echoes in Tokyo Story later on are, you know, trying to take care of the most elderly members of the family and going from, you know, house to house, and of the brothers and sisters of the Toda family after the death of the patriarch. But later on in the film, you know, after you know, we're trying to decide where to house, you know, the mother who's now a widow. One of the good son, the unmarried son, Shojiro, says, "Oh, come with me to, you know, China, where we have a military outpost." And that is, it's like, if you were to do like a deconstructionist approach of this film, you'd say, well, that's like a big omission that there. Yeah. It's a quite gentle Ozu family film on the surface, but actually,
yeah,
there's quite a bit of darkness there, and it omits, you know, the war atrocities and war crimes of the period. The fact that you think that the military outpost in China is somewhere you would take your elderly mother,
yeah,
says a lot about some, yeah, of the assumptions of Japanese imperialism,
yeah,
to me.
Well, it's quite interesting. I mean, I think that makes me think it connects actually to arguments that are being had at the moment about Nolan's Oppenheimer and its exclusion of you know, images of the actual impact of the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And there's a sort of debate online, I think, a little bit, where some people have accused the film of, I don't know, leaving those things out in a culpable way, whereas other people have tried to defend the film as their sort of principled exclusions, you know, things that are left out for a reason which is not the same as them being ignored or papered over, and what, you know, and yeah, whatever one thinks about that, it's interesting to think about, yeah, the things that are not in this film, the fact that they're not in them or the fact that they're not mentioned explicitly is not the same as them not being in the film in a wider sense, or sort of something which is probably assumed to be in the minds of the people watching it, particularly when it was a new film at the time. Mm. Yeah, it's very interesting.
Yeah, and I've gone in hard with a particular interpretation of the film, but I think that the reason why it is a noticeable omission is precisely because it's framed by some of those Ozu trademarks of this is a family matter, not necessarily a national matter, or that sort of in the background.
Yeah.
But then it kind of pulls you back, into the
I mean,
the
there's
period.
Also there's a one of the other extras on this in the Blu-ray, is a very nice film that was made in Japan. I forget actually what it's called, but made on one of the anniversaries of his death. So it's in the 90s. I don't know if you've watched that.
Have you watched that?
No, I just watched it the other day.
Illuminating.
It's just very nicely done. So all it consists of is shots of various parts of the world, and then after each sort of sequence, so you see some shots of I don't know Helsinki, and then you get a sequence with what's his name? Well, edit this bit. Who's the really famous Finnish film director beginning with a K?
Kieślowski?
No, he's Polish.
Oh, sorry. We will edit this.
We'll definitely edit this bit.
Kaurismäki?
Yeah. I had Kiera Starmi in my head. Okay.
There are a lot of great Ks.
I'll start again on this. So what the film basically consists of is shots of particular parts of the world. So you might get a sequence of shots of Helsinki, and then, as you do, I think, and then after that, there's a sequence with Kaurismäki, which I think it seems like he's clearly directed himself, just sort of talking about Ozu and talking about what Ozu means to him. And, you know, the film does this with a bunch of directors. So Wim Wenders is in there, and Lindsay Anderson, and, you know, Hosi Asien, etc. Anyway, and it's very nicely done. But one of the things, and I think Wim Wenders sort of says this, but he sort of talks about how some people see Ozu as something, I don't know if he uses the word exotic, but at least sort of something sort of quintessentially Japanese and something very different from, I don't know, Western traditions of film, and with sort of specific references to that part of the world and its history and culture. But he says, like, he can't think of a filmmaker who's more universal than Ozu. He just thinks that Ozu is the most universal filmmaker, which is... Yeah, an interesting point, because it sort of suggests to me that, in fact, the reason that you might think that that's not the case is because the films are so, I mean, to our eyes and ears, I suppose, so obviously Japanese, you might think, okay, so the way to make a sort of universal film would be to sort of strip out those specific things, sort of somehow, to have a film that didn't have the signifiers, whereas, like, actually, there's a more interesting idea about it. In fact, you can sort of go through them, because there's no such thing as making a film that's not from a particular place in a particular time.
Yes. It strikes me that similar things were said about Satyajit Ray.
Yeah.
And his filmmaking was regarded as having some kind of universal, like, human values argument going on. This is not that kind of film. I think it'd be very easy to... read Ozu in that way. But this is the film that started to make me think a little bit differently about some of the more culturally specific references. And those are the two extremes, I suppose. There's the argument that, this film is very Japanese and, you know, it has to somehow encapsulate Japanese culture, and that's how we're going to approach this in terms of its style, in terms of performance and whatever. And then the other argument is, oh no, you know, it has these universal qualities, we can all sort of relate to it. This film, at least in its historical sort of omissions, started to make me think of it differently about what's under the hood of some of those Ozu trademarks that have now become so discussed, they feel quite familiar.
Yeah. I mean, it is such a difficult, sort of an opposition that's hard not to think in terms of sort of at all, but is one, like you say, that has so many traps and sort of sets up these possibilities of oppositions which are too binary. Like you say, so either you go, oh, this film is so Japanese therefore the only thing we can talk about is sort of Japanese-ness or something. You know, that could be a kind of limiting, or yeah, you get into quite potentially banal and hand-wavy sort of ideas about the universal human condition or something, which yeah, could quite easily not really take you very far, or in fact problematically obscure some of the differences about this being a Japanese film versus a film made somewhere else. But how do you negotiate those two? I mean, it struck me, I mean, think of that as a binary opposition which then sets itself up, but then is I don't know if I want to use the word deconstructs itself, but you know, but then something that invites, seems to offer itself, but then generates problems. I mean, it's an Ozu trait in general, isn't it, to work with binary oppositions of other and of other kinds. And that's something that struck me about that I really loved about the beginning of this film, is how clearly it sets up like a whole load of them. You know, there's, because it starts with when the patriarch of the family is still alive, and there's a family portrait being taken, but you get the old versus the young, you get the Western versus the Japanese, because the his second son, as you said, who turns out to sort of be the good son in a certain sense, although that's probably too simplistic, but he's pissing his father off because he's late, and one of his sisters goes to get him, and he's dressed in more traditional Japanese dress, and he changes into a suit. And then there's male and female, you know, the differences between the sexes.
Even simple things like Japan is a big exporter of camera technology, and I think they discuss, oh, we're using the Leica, you know, right. so a Western camera model. And the film, if you look hard enough, it's from Japan, but it's also, you know, transnational in various ways as well.
Yeah. It's deliberately and clearly working with things that seem, you know, pairs or sort of binary oppositions, as I said, like the ones that we've just mentioned about East, West, old, new, young, old, male, female. But the very way that it starts with that, you obviously know that it can't end with that, you know. These aren't things that are, I mean, they set up problems rather than offering solutions. So actually maybe thinking about the film in terms of some sort of a problematic opposition between sort of the specifically Japanese and the universal, you know, or whatever that would mean, is there'll be ways of doing it which are not imposing a form of reading on the film, but are actually could be working with forms of signification or something that the film itself seems to be sort of playing with and kind of based on.
I think the film is partly about different values, isn't it?
Mm.
Whether that's the sort of the patriarch, he's clearly a family man and is enjoying old age, but at the same time has made some sort of reckless investments, and clearly, although he's a prominent businessman, he's not less of a raging capitalist who really kind of takes care of his finances and all of that.
Or he's a poor raging capitalist. I mean, poor in the sense of, you know, not very good, raging capitalist. Or maybe that opens up the question of, what it means to be a successful capitalist on the surface. And, for him, I suppose he was successful while he lived, as far as lots of people knew, and then it's his family who have to deal with the consequences of the truth that becomes revealed when he's... Yeah,
that's just one of the values that are discussed quite openly in the film. It's the, what is the legacy of our father, and kind of makes you think of Akira Kurosawa. You know, you have the death of a main character, and then you reflect on, okay, how did they live their life, and giving these sort of slightly different interpretations of
and
the
class,
legacy.
Class, of course, is another, like, it's more complicated than binary, but kind of binary opposition in the film, precisely because the family is, it's not just that they're wealthy, but the fact that they're wealthy at the beginning of the film. I mean, yeah, the kind of wider family, you know, how many children are there? So there's, I mean, this is what the film is about, right?
The brothers and sisters.
Are there five? Are there three sons and two daughters?
That's what I thought, yes.
Or six. Maybe there are three sons and three daughters. I find it slightly hard to keep track.
There are also not blood relatives, aren't there, as well, that presumably might be counted as
their husbands and wives. But anyway, there's a sense which this is a, you know, it's very definitely, it's not an aristocratic family. That would be, that's not the right category. Again, it's, okay, this is to do with, you know, Japanese history and, you know, Japanese capitalism, but it's definitely an upper class family. And then precisely the fact that then their financial problems after the father dies means that there's a certain amount of soul searching, or a certain absence of soul searching, where there should be some, as to what status the family occupies now that, you know, so one of the daughters in particular is adamant that they have to keep living in the way that they kept living, because that's the kind of people we are, you know.
Yes, that's one of the conflicts that leads the mother to be moved on elsewhere.
Whereas the mother's much more humble, it seems, or much more sort of, she's kind of quietly pragmatic, isn't she?
Yes, or quietly culpable in some ways for not trying to tell her husband to drink less, or sort of facilitating his alcoholism to some extent. Or
it might be a mad thought. It just occurs to me that also, going back to you having linked in, talked about war as a sort of absent presence in the film and stuff. But I don't know if this really is importing something from outside. But something which occurred to me, and this would also be a sort of anachronistic Kurosawa connection. But it did make me think of King Lear. You know, of course, it's not the king has died, but the king, in inverted commas, has died. But the wife has to go the wife and mother has to go and live with each of the children in turn, and in each case they find a reason, you know, to kick her out, or she finds, that's basically what happens, right? There's a reason why it's deemed to be unsustainable. I don't know.
I wouldn't be surprised, and not that it needs to, we need to establish some kind of causality, but I think Ozu did, had a really like turbulent kind of education and failed a number of kind of admissions exams and things like that. But I think he did in the end go to film school, and I wouldn't be surprised if Shakespeare was a sort of a model, you know, like you can imagine like the structure of a story, you know, Shakespeare might have been a model. But yes, I can see it now. I'd not thought of it before, but dividing up the kingdom, what little kingdom there is left.
I'd need to think it through more, because there's not really a... I mean, there's sort of not. It's sort of a bit like a Lear without either a Lear or a Cordelia, which doesn't really work. But there was just sort of something there which I felt this must be... I mean, must is strong, but it felt to me that's somehow informing the texture of it.
Perhaps this is a very corny sort of A-level type reading of the movie, but is it significant that time is just an important theme in Ozu in any case? And this film has various kind of articulations of that, you know, both in terms of it's about a generational shift and a changing of the guard, but it's also about... capturing the family quite literally, you know, photographically at the start at a point in time. And then I think it ends with a freeze frame of the sun, you know, running off onto the beach. And so I'm just really sort of thinking aloud about this, but there is something about capturing a family at a particular point in time, but also then leaving things unresolved and open-ended. And this, you know, you can't help but think of the ending of the 400 blows when you see that. This is running across the beach and the freeze frame ending. But he's running away from us, you know.
You know, think of the sort of things that it's not, you know. And if the film wanted to sort of to give us a more direct kind of, you know, message about the passing of time and society, I think it would have just kind of fluffed it, because it's not very clear, which I think, you know, suggests that that's not the kind of thing it's trying to do, which doesn't mean it's not exploring those questions, but it doesn't seem to be to have a kind of programmatic moral it wants us to draw.
I think it's more about how the family relates to that. So we really need to take this photo. Oh, I'm late to the photo. It doesn't matter, you know.
That's really nice. Like, late is it, because that's about time as well, right? He's not, you know, having demands on your time. And on your space, to be in a particular place at a particular time. It's interesting, but the film starts with, yeah, this sort of prominent character, as I said, who's also often not in the film. It starts with him not being where he should at a particular time.
Yeah. So I think, you know, while it being, you know, having a kind of contemporary appeal, whether that's its genre or not, it also exceeds its time by being about that to some extent, you know. Not that it has one thing to say about time, but clearly it's a problem within the family, you know. Untimely death and being late to things or running away from future responsibilities is a definite theme.
Absolutely.
Shall we watch a clip?
Yes, let's do that. So are we going to watch the sequence where the second son Shojiro has a go at his siblings? Is that what we decided?
Sounds good.
Yeah. Okay.
Near the end, but not the end.
Yeah. And I said it kind of a sort of set piece, because I suppose interesting about the way the film works with time, that, again, as also with Ozu, it's interesting which scenes are not represented directly, you know, and certain things that, you know, another filmmaker might actually show you are sort of referred to off screen. But this is a sort of, it's a sequence that has quite a, you know, it has a continuity, you know, a kind of, as it were, real-time sort of continuity, right? That, you know, the family is gathered for... Is it the first anniversary of the father's death, I think? And then...
They're in a temple, aren't they?
And, yeah.
And having food.
And they're eating after the memorial service, sort of proper, and then he has a go on them, and then they leave sort of, you know, one by one. So there's kind of a... There's a temporal and spatial unity to this particular scene. It sort of plays out basically in, as I said, in sort of one-to-one, you know, the film time is sort of plausible with the dramatic time, or sort of maps onto the dramatic time. But also there's a sense in which it's, there's a kind of staging, like there's something performative about it, you know, within the context of the film, right? It's not, sort of, I mean, within the, within the film world, you know, there's sort of something about it's not just that it makes sort of allusions to I don't know, ritual or hierarchy. There's, I feel like the characters themselves are sort of aware that the designer decided to make this, you know, it's a sort of public statement, even though the public is only his particular family that he's.
It recalls to some extent an earlier scene where they are. They're trying to plan ahead, and the eldest son is saying basically we have to sell off the estate, and, you know, kind of, do you agree?
Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's over tea, you know.
I suppose that I just,
so that's, yeah, one of those significant sort of family meetings.
Yes, yeah. I think what I'm just grasping towards is something, I think it's something that interests me in general in film. I think sequences in which characters are aware that they're in some sense performing or sort of aware of the performance which they're giving, you know, as characters are often worthy of note. I think they're quite interesting, you know, rather than thinking simply of an opposite, you know, between, okay, you know, this is a character who is obviously being performed by an actor, but the character is sort of just being. But there's moments when characters are sort of self-consciously doing something, and when it's also a sort of a climactic, a sort of important structural moment in the film, as this is.
Great. So we've just watched a clip, about 7 minutes worth of this film, from just before 1 hour 30 minutes up to like 1 hour 36:44. I'm just looking at the time code over Dominic's shoulder. So if you wanted to watch this sequence, it's an important moment in the film, and it strikes me now as actually being quite hard hitting as well, and because there's no reconciliation, you know, after this. The brothers and sisters, apart from the, you know, three members of the family, the whole family leaves, you know, and then that's it. That's their stage exit.
Yeah. Right. And it opens up precisely the questions we were talking about before, about sort of, you know, universality and you know, Japanese-ness, because it's very, as we were saying before we watched the clip, it's quite sort of formal, both as it sort of plays out cinematically, but it's quite formal in the film world, as this, yes, this, you know, moment after the, well, you know, at the meal after the father's memorial service, when the son, you know, chooses to voice his complaints and literally to expel one by one his brothers and sisters and brothers-in-law, you know, from the room. So there's a sort of quite stark and sort of quite clear process going on, but also, of course, there's also, like, there may well be specifics of Japanese or specificities of Japanese etiquette which would, I think, I get the impression, probably not entirely transform our understanding, but might be eluding us. And the bit when his sister, the one who's unmarried and is staying with the mother, later in the sequence, when she starts crying, I'm assuming that's some sort of humiliation. Well, I mean, I don't know. I think there could be a number of reasons why she's crying, but it's kind of embarrassing. And so, you know, we get that. But I also, I don't know if there are, as I said, specifics of the kind of things that one definitely does or doesn't do at this kind of situation, which would only increase its impact.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it is abrupt, and thinking in quite generalist terms, you wouldn't want this to happen at the anniversary of your father's death.
Quite.
For there to be a squabble. But there is a sense that also this is, you know, socially, you know, quite embarrassing as well. And I suppose that's why the waitresses are dismissed first.
Well, that sort of makes a link, though, with the, you know, with it means that what's done to the family is what was done to the waitresses, which is obviously perhaps has a kind of demeaning. You can see how that would be taken, you know, to be a demeaning thing to do, which I think is quite deliberate. I mean, that's sort of what I mean. Like, yeah, having said, okay, perhaps there are specifics about a Japanese dish. On the other hand, you go, this is quite a formal situation, which is the memorial for the father, and the son makes a fuss and tells everyone that they're behaving badly. So, well, of course, that would be humiliating. We don't need to know any specifics. But which is not to say that, you know, that someone with a great expertise in Japanese culture would, I'm sure, be able to bring things to the discussion that we can't have. So sort of both things seem to be true.
This sequence kind of makes me feel even more strongly that we are meant to take the Sino-Japanese War and World War II into account when discussing the character of Shojiro, because he seems to be above or outside a lot of that etiquette. In the sense, he's not worried about keeping up appearances if it means that the family is in a kind of deeper turmoil. He's not sort of lost in those, you know, polite sort of rituals.
Yes, or he's prepared to deliberately use the fact. I mean, he's not a character who's so sort of. One could imagine a different version in which, like you say, through his war experiences, he's kind of become sort of detached from the etiquette, so he just doesn't care. He just feels this just doesn't apply. The world, you know, these things are too limiting. Whereas this is a very deliberate choice of the moment in which he decides to make this point and how he decides to do it. So it's almost, I feel more, I mean, I don't sort of disagree, but he makes a calculated choice to use the fact that this is not the kind of thing that one does to heighten the emotional intensity, rather than him just being sort of so uncaring about the right thing to do that he just doesn't give a shit.
You know? I agree with you. Maybe there's something there about his cultural memory, or somehow he sees more clearly by being a bit of an outsider by this point, and can see that this is not how things are meant to go.
Yeah. I think cinematically it's really worth that. I mean, I guess these are the odd, but it's the mise-en-scene, you know, the placement of the bodies in the space and then in the frame, and the editing are so, they're sort of all part of that in formality, right? The sequence, how sort of cinematically as well as narratively. I love the thing I hadn't noticed previously. So there's a shot that we return to quite frequently, where it's a classic Ozu, the camera, you know, low on the floor looking up, in which you can see the all of the family sort of they're kind of sat at right angles to one another. So the women are sort of to the left of the frame, and the men are the men are at right angles to them, but you know, directly ahead of us as we look at them. But a thing I hadn't noticed previously, at the beginning of the sequence, the two waitresses are sort of out of focus towards the camera on the right of the frame, which means that we can't see Shojiro because he's blocked by them. So that means that the first time we see him is when there's a cut to a one shot of him. So it sort of it kind of gives him a distinctly sort of cinematic entrance, and then after that he dismisses the waitresses, they stand up and leave, and he's revealed sort of behind them. But that's not the moment which we first see him, because that would be another way of sort of making his presence felt quite. But interestingly, we've already seen him, but we could have seen him sort of out of nowhere, even though he's there.
Yeah, I think that's really astute. Yeah, reading of this staging, I have to watch Ozu's films a couple of times usually, because it's like one of those Shakespeare plays with lots of characters, and it's quite important that you know the individuals involved, but you also have a visual guide often as to what's going on. I hadn't noticed so much the Shojiro's, the blocking, and but I think that's very important. One thing that it left me with was just a scene of diminishing sort of company, basically, be through repetition and variation. So having that long shot, maybe like four times of the looking in at the ceremony, first with the whole party, and then just with the brothers and sisters, and then just with the three family members at the end, is I think quite striking.
There's a kind of erosion of the company, literally. Yeah, and I think one could sort of probably go quite a long way with extending the analysis in terms of how the framing and the editing group the various people, because there's actually, you know, like you say, there are shots which repeat. So sort of not only that shot which more or less lets us see all of them, although the women are harder to see because the line is sort of, you know, they're in a line sort of at right angles to the plane of the frame, so it's a bit. But anyway, you can more or less sort of see them all, and there are also sort of there are camera setups where you only see the women or you only see the men, but then there are variations of them, and of course they change, like you say, as people leave. So there's the shot of only the men, which to begin with is three men, but then are after one of his brothers-in-law has been diminished, it becomes two. But then you also get new setups. So I think, you know, that the way the characters are grouped and the way that makes us think about either what unites them or what doesn't, and how those patterns kind of play out through the film. I think you could write a whole essay on that.
When we're describing it, it makes it sound like the style is very sort of on the nose, but that's not right either, because I think it is rigorous but not kind of fussy, and it kind of does the style kind of almost like dissolves, you know, over the course of watching the film, and you don't notice it so much. Whereas I don't know, I feel like if this were an Orson Welles film, you'd say, look at that amazing sort of deep focus, which is we have here in the sort of long shots, but because we've been treated to this so many times, and because it kind of suits the occasion, and maybe because the characters are static, we don't seem to have to comment on the, you know, virtuoso sort
of. No, that's really interesting.
Staging,
And it's quite slow. It feels quite slow, you know. I feel the scene, but I think that's again sort of because what's happening in the film world, it is being played out with a sort of deliberate slowness that, you know, again, like an alternative thing would be for the son to have lost his temper and then said to everyone apart from his mother and sister, you know, get out of here, but he dismisses them one by one. And it's important, he's not the oldest son, isn't it? That's another thing also. So he's sort of usurping, there's a certain sense in which the oldest son, who's obviously, you know, this you don't need to know about Japan to know that the eldest son is clearly is the one who's assumed to be to have the have taken on the senior role after the father dies, but he's you know, he doesn't say it explicitly, but the his younger brother is saying, you've what's the word? You've kind of voided your claim to that by the way that you've behaved. So I'm stepping up because someone has to, you know.
It's on paper, he's actually, you know, the one that ordering everyone around is not the kind of most promising young sort of prospect. You know, he's not married, and he's not the oldest, and
he's also not the youngest. Yeah, that's interesting as
but
well.
But he's in the middle, so it's because it's Tetsuo Saito is the oldest, the actor who plays the oldest brother, I think.
Yeah,
who is in I Was Born But, where he's the father who is actually a bit of a more of a comic,
and he kind of gets
character.
Humiliated, you know, because he falls very much in his sons hold him up on a pedestal, and then they find that he sort of clowns around for his boss. Yeah, and it's if one has the memories of that role, as people could have had this time.
I think it was 8 years previous or something like that. So,
so there's something of that, isn't there? There's a similar kind of falling not loss of status, but a sort of falling away of illusions, you know, that, the kind of hollowness of his claim to occupy a certain status is exposed.
He also he doesn't appear strong for what that's worth.
No.
And the film is about frailty to some extent. Yeah. But the first time we see him, you know, he's, you know, in his chair and he's under a blanket and he's quite a thin, as an actor, he's quite a thin man, isn't he, as well? The son seems the son who sort of comes forward is quite, you know, vibrant and
There's no there's no camera movement at all, is there, as far as I noticed, which I think would have to watch it again to be totally sure, but I don't think there's any, which again sort of contributes to that perhaps sense that you were talking about how it's possible to sort of for the star to seem very kind of transparent and almost because it's also but also the editing is fast enough that it's not, again, it would be different if the shots were held for even longer, because then the style would, I think, start to become more prominent sort of simply through formal aspects not changing, but it's got a slowness, but it's also got a sufficient momentum of editing that I think probably contributes to that sense you're talking about how it's possible to sort of think you can sort of look through the style, and yet when you start to pay explicit attention to it, it definitely seems to be one of those instances in which the style is sort of, it sounds very negative, but you know, the style is sort of Mickey Mousing the content. I mean, that's not the right word, because but you know, the way the style on the cinematic, the sort of stylistic decisions are working is reinforcing the way that things are happening in the narrative and then the character by, you know, kind of doing something similar with its own means rather than counterpointing it, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I suppose the moment is one of disruption, but the style remains the same or familiar, you know, from what we've seen before, so as to foreground that the breaking with convention is dramatic, but the stylistic convention sort of stays the same.
Or although maybe it's sort of intensified. Maybe it doesn't sort of it's a sort of, it's doing something similar to the rest of the film stylistically, but sort of more so.
I'm going to try something new at this point because I feel we need to, you know, there's other films to discuss on the podcast. Are there any kind of not concluding thoughts, but any sort of things that you feel the film leaves you with that you'd like to kind of look at more, or maybe in other films that you're watching, or one thing I was thinking about was maybe because the film is distributed by the BFI as a two-pack with Tokyo Story, suggesting maybe this film is like a draft or is somehow related to Tokyo Story. I'd like to go back to Tokyo Story, basically, and think in terms of stylistic development or, you know, narrative echoes and the treatment of place. I feel like there's some really interesting stuff around like coastal locations in this film, which kind of kind of creep in. I'd like to do a bit of work on like city and coast and things like that.
Yeah, I think I'd like to, I think maybe I'm contradicting something I suggested earlier. Because there are quite a lot of characters, I think actually, a greater familiarity with the film would actually open up the sense of reading things more from these different characters' points of view. I think there would probably be sort of aspect of that that I've somewhat neglected, because a certain part of the first hour or 45 minutes is actually sort of to get into grips with who is who. Very deliberately, I think, but again, I think the film is obviously sort of, then deliberately sort of opens itself up to conveying something different on a second viewing, because you'll meet people who you already know. And so I think, sort of having made that contrast I made earlier about saying, with Late String, that there's that possibility of reading the whole film differently on a second viewing if you start to read it from the father's viewpoint. I think something not so sort of drastic as that, but actually each of the characters is so sort of well drawn, even if, as I was saying before, it's not necessarily that it's massively ambiguous about how we feel about how they behave. But I think probably there are perspectives that I've definitely neglected, simply because you can only follow so many threads on a single viewing of a film. So it'd be interesting to see where it would sort of take us to put more attention on one or other of the other characters.
Yeah, I think actually you've sold me on that. It's something I'd like to do as well. Maybe give it a third viewing. But for now, I'll just say thank you for listening to the podcast. My name is Stephen Roberts.
My name's Dominic Lash.
And please do subscribe. We're on Spotify, Acast, and other streaming services. We will be back very shortly with another film to discuss. Bye.
Bye.